Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome. This is the Daughters and Sons Hour, a weekly discussion concerning the support needs of daughters and sons of parents with mental illness. My name is Joe Donovan. I will be your host for the night. Tonight, we will be discussing developing supports for parents who have a mental illness. Our first guest is Dr. Joanna Nicholson, who is a clinical and research psychologist and professor of psychiatry at Dartmouth Psychiatry Research Center. She's an adjunct professor of psychiatry at the University of Massachusetts Medical School, and has been really been kind of a leader on this discussion of supporting parents with mental illness. I first learned 10 years ago from a book that she authored, referred to as Parenting Well. What is Parenting Well When You Are Depressed? I'm going to introduce hello, are you there?
Yep, we're here.
Dr. Nicholson. Okay. Welcome. We also have a second guest on tonight, and that is Tony Wolf, who is the executive director of an organization called Employment Options, which is a service, which is an organization that which provides services to various mental health services to individuals, including some parenting support service. Welcome. Are you there too, also Tony?
Yes, I am.
Okay. So everyone's on. So I guess I want to start off really with how this topic really developed. And I know, as I said, the first person I've seen who's actually written a lot about this was you, Dr. Nicholson. Could you explain how you got started with this whole interest?
Oh, sure. I would be happy to. I was actually thinking today in preparation for this broadcast that it's been over 25 years that I've been engaged in this work, and so that was a little bit of a rude awakening for me earlier today when I counted up the years. But it was about 25 years ago that I was working at the UMass Medical School and as part of an evaluation group. I'm a psychologist, a clinical and a research psychologist by training, and we did evaluations for the Child Welfare Agency and for the court, family court, in situations where parental competence, when a parent's capacity to take care of a child or children was in question. And I think because we were sitting in a psychiatry department, we were often referred parents whose issues were psychiatric in nature. And after you do we did hundreds of these evaluations, you begin to see certain patterns emerge about, the circumstances of people's lives and the situations they find themselves in, and whether you think that supports and services are adequate to help them. But one of the first evaluations I did was a mom who was, diagnosed with multiple things, very serious psychiatric diagnoses, and I was young. I was young and I was enthusiastic and I was going to save children. That was my goal. And I evaluated her and administered all kinds of psychological tests and met with her many, many times. And she was really quite ill and had been quite ill for a while. And the what happens once you do these evaluations is you have to go to court and be an expert witness and testify about these things. And I remember this day in court very well. It's almost like I have a PTSD kind of reaction when I think about it. But, you know, I don't know, Joe, if you've ever been in a car accident or in a situation where everything turns into slow motion. It's like you're seeing things happen in slow motion and you can't prevent them from happening, but you're just watching them all happen. And I remember what I was wearing. I remember standing up in court and talking about this woman. And, you know, unfortunately, she was quite ill and all of her test results were quite negative. And so I really spent a couple of hours doing a complete laundry list of all the things that were wrong with this woman. The unfortunate part about that experience was that the woman was sitting in the courtroom in front of me. And when the judge called a recess to go to lunch, I sort of marched myself down from the witness stand and she came up to me and she came up behind me and she tapped me on the shoulder and she said, "Joanne, couldn't you just say one nice thing about me?" And I thought, holy cow, this poor woman, I mean, admittedly, she was quite ill, and she was well aware that she was quite ill. But I had managed to spend 2 or 3 hours filling up the time with everything I thought that was wrong with her, which clearly was not a particularly strengths-based approach to the work I was doing at the time. Now, ironically, a couple of years later, I was supervising a psychiatry resident. And in psychiatry, the residents are either doing adult mental health rotations or child mental health rotations. And my trainee was doing an adult rotation at the state hospital. And he came to see me one day. I was his child psychiatry supervisor. And he came to me and he was incredibly anxious and pacing and agitated and he couldn't sit still. And I tried to calm him down and I said, "What's wrong? You know, what's," he said, "I can't tell you about it. I can't talk about it. You're my child supervisor, and this is about an adult client." And I said, "Well, what is it?" And he said, "We have this patient at the state hospital, and she's really delusional and really, really crazy, and she thinks she has kids, and she keeps trying to escape from the unit because she thinks that they're out there. People are trying to get her kids and take them away from her." And the more that he talked about his patient, the more that I realized it was my woman. It was the mother I had evaluated a few years before then. And in fact, she did have kids, and in fact, she could easily have perceived that someone was out to get them. In this instance, it was the child welfare system. And my poor psychiatry trainee had no idea, because he was doing his adult rotation, and nobody on the adult mental service unit asked their patients whether they were parents. And so he had no idea, actually, that her delusions, in quotation marks, were in fact reality, based in reality. And so that didn't seem very much like integrated services to me. Certainly adult and child services weren't integrated. But then, if you roll the clock then another couple of years ahead, I was actually administering, supervising, and running post-adoption services for kids in central Massachusetts. And who should walk through the door but the children of this same woman who were disrupting, that's such a clinical, their adoptive parents were no longer able to take care of them because they had so many behavioral problems. And so these children who I thought I was saving by testifying in court about this woman who was quite ill, in fact, ended up in the system again, which I, you know, clearly believe is, well, certainly wasn't a very family-centered approach, but also was, in fact, systems-induced trauma to these children and this family. And I, at that point, became really committed to trying to figure out whether there were better ways to work together with families to promote positive outcomes for them, because this whole, you know, child welfare, family court, foster care, it didn't seem to be working very well. And that's actually how I met Tony Wolf, my colleague and partner who is on the line with us tonight, because that was when we began our first research projects about families where parents have mental health conditions. And Tony was my first agency partner, and actually helped us put together the very first focus groups we had of parents at her agency, Employment Options. And Tony, I don't know if you want to say a little bit about that or...
Sure. You know, it's interesting, as you're talking, Joanne, we both come from a place of ignorance around this topic initially, and it's really sad. But, you know, I think out of challenges, we become insightful. And I think for me, how I got involved is basically a dad coming forward, talking about how in his psychiatric illness, he had lost his family and wanted to really have visitation to see his kids. And I had been just had my first child at the time, and I started talking about, obviously I was pregnant, and people started talking to me and asking me about my daughter. And it was the first time members in our organization started talking about their children. And it was one of those aha moments. And because of this particular dad who came forward, it was the first time I really thought about being a parent, what it means for people, and the lack of services. And so, as Joanne said, we've been doing this for a while. It's been a steep hill, and in terms of trying to get this issue funded continually, to try to continually advocate for this issue, very much like our parents, who really struggle day to day at times, and also struggle to be heard.
Exactly.
So that's really how I came about, and I think for Joanne and I, we've both been doing service delivery. We both have been learning from our parents. We've both been trying to research and document what does work, and to really support people and to acknowledge their identity as a parent. This has been an enormous human service gap that we have had in our industry, and it needs to stop. So does that help, Joe, a little bit of an overview for you?
Oh, yes, absolutely. You know, my personal story is that, you know, I was raised in the system myself. My mother had schizophrenia. She raised two children on her own in the whole AFDC thing, and she also had some mental health services. So I come from a background where I've been through that process. So I'm quite familiar with the systems and the gaps and disconnects, which is really one of the reasons I was really excited to have the two of you on here, because of the fact that this is an area where obviously it's been focusing on for a while and are trying to really both provide services and also educate others about these needs. I started the discussion of this because I noticed this book came out a few months ago on which is called Mothers, Mental Illness, and Recovery, which is a very large book, which starts off with some chapters by some researchers and has also a number of chapters written by actual women who are mothers and their personal experience. Dr. Nicholson actually wrote the first chapter of this book, and actually two of our guests from the last week wrote a couple of chapters as well, as speaking from their prospective daughters. And I'd like, if you could, Dr. Nicholson, tell me a little bit about how that book was developed and why.
Oh, sure. And I want to do a little shout-out for the book myself. The editors are Nicole Benders-Hoddy and Mary Barber, who contacted many contributors to prepare chapters for the book. And so it really was their leadership and a group effort that resulted in Motherhood, Mental Illness, and Recovery. And the subtitle is Stories of Hope. And I want to say a little bit, Joe, before we dive into the book about about this notion of, well, about the spin, you know, because it's a book with the word motherhood in the title. It's, you know, women's stories. It's research and professional strategies for supporting women as mothers. And I want to be sure that people understand that that really it's about families for us. And I guess I say this because lots of times I'm sort of typecast as a parent advocate because, and Tony too, I think, because we often talk about parents and what happens for parents and what happens in the system for parents. And I want to be sure that people understand that from my perspective, at least, we're talking about families. And if you can help a parent do better, then you can help children do better and vice versa, that it's a systems kind of thing. And by trying to bring attention to the adult, the parent, the mother in the mental health system, I mean, that's really our goal on behalf of the entire family. And I also want to say that I've seen incredibly positive things happen in the child welfare system. You know, I'm not about systems bashing either, because I think that people in those systems and agencies have really difficult jobs. And I think, unfortunately, there are times when parents are not well able to care for their children. Frankly, I think that's true of parents who live with mental illness and, in fact, those who don't live with mental illness. And so I think that it's important that those systems and services are in place. But I think, as Tony points out, there has really been a lack of attention to the positive ways that we can support entire families to do better. And that by supporting parents or supporting children, we're really, our goal is to contribute to the well-being of the whole family. So anyway, this book is about motherhood, mental illness, and recovery. And I also wanted to say a little bit about what I've been thinking about recovery, because it means different things to different people. And some people don't like the word recovery because it seems like it sort of comes out of a medical background. You know, you have an illness or you're sick and then you recover, and people may think that psychiatric disorders or mental health conditions don't quite fit into that. It's not like having the flu, you know, that lasts for 5 days and then you're over it. I think it's important for me, to say that my feeling about recovery is that, and my thinking about recovery is that it's about a process. It's about a journey, not a destination, that it's not about cure per se. And, you know, I think there's a distinction to be made between healing and cure. And I think that it is about healing, and it's about healing for the person who's diagnosed with the psychiatric disorder or the mental health condition, as well as the people who live with that person, the people who are around that person as a social support network, or living with that person in a neighborhood, in a community. I think recovery is a process that involves everyone and has benefits for everyone. And so that's actually one of the points that I tried to make in this first chapter of mine, which is the opening chapter of the book, which is to provide a framework for thinking about motherhood and recovery as a family process.
You know, I just would like to add that, and I think that, you know, we provide services, and we see the incredible value when because mental health issues impacts everybody in the family. And as Joe, you said about being a son, you know, there are lots of sons and daughters that are impacted by mental illness. At the same token, that has not been understood. And so I think that the challenge for us is to really be able to embrace the whole family, to talk to the child and help the parent talk about their illness, to really have a dialogue together around those issues, and to really support so that everyone feels visible, so everyone is acknowledged for the role that they play in the family and the strengths that they provide in that family. That includes parents, that includes children, it might be include people's natural support systems. It all matters. And I think that, you know, we have seen over the years around recovery that, you know, that means that for some people, you know, they don't need services any longer, that they have developed the natural supports in their lives so that they can rely on them in addition to their own understanding of their illness. And then for other people, they may require a longer-term support. But again, it's really about what are the needs of the family. And I think that's critical, and in a country that focuses on family, for some reason we have not acknowledged parental mental health and what that impacts the family and how that can change.
Thank you. One of the other questions, and it's again one of the things that I've noticed from my experience, I think that few people realize when we talk about kind of the services for mental for the services is that it's not just mental health services, it's not just adult mental health services. And Dr. Nicholson, you mentioned that there is that other issues of child welfare, the legal system, and education.
Sure.
And maybe if you could talk a little bit about that, and also Tony about, you know, how you help parents kind of navigate all of these different things. Because there really are multiple, and in some cases there may be issues with homelessness and supported housing, and how that works for family, because it really can get really complicated really quickly.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think, you know, sort of the underlying problem in thinking about these things is that our system, the U.S. system, is very much a medical model healthcare system, and so reimbursement for all these services is really targeted to individuals with diagnoses and medically necessary treatment requirements. And so, for example, for children in the home who may not be diagnosed with a mental health condition, it's hard to put together the resources to provide supports to those children, even though their parent may be quite ill with, you know, one disorder or another. And so actually the notion of wrapping services around families is a little bit complicated, as Tony can share with you, because of the way that our healthcare system works and the way that services are reimbursed. But I also think it's possible to be, to do parent-informed work or family-informed work, and that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to see all the family members, but you pay respect to their family roles and responsibilities and the ways in which they think about their goals and objectives and their strengths and resources in the context of their family. And Tony's had a ton of experience piecing together some of the simplest and some of the most complex supports for families over the years. And I'm wondering, Tony, if you want to say a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, first I want to just talk about, as you mentioned, Joe, about the legal system. And I think that the first venue that we struggled with was how to really support parents legally. Because we're not attorneys. We did not know how to advise some of our parents who may have been in the system, the child welfare system, who may be on the cusp of losing their children. And so we were able to, with lots of supporters, develop a service so that we would have attorneys available to really guide parents, to let them know what their parental rights are. And at times, combine services so that when we went into court, we could say, with these services, this parent can manage and have their children be returned to the family. So each family is very complex, and legal issues often does, sadly, get into the mix. I think we also, as Joanne said, I, like our parents, really felt that child welfare was the enemy. And really, because of a project that Joanne was able to really pull together for us through funding, we all sat down, parents, DCF workers, people that had were major stakeholders in the community to really understand each other's point of view and really realize that many times people's hands are really tied because of the system. And so I learned over time that no one is the enemy, that it's a complex system and that everyone has to kind of try to figure out sometimes what are the barriers and how we get around those barriers. I think I've also learned really about maximizing people's natural support systems. And I'm going to give you a perfect example. We have a family that we have known for many, many years who uses our services for many years. And she recently, in the last 2 years, had an infant who had needed medical care. She had 3 children at home. And her husband needed to go to work. So instantly, as we were visiting this infant in the emergency room and realizing that mom needed to be there, our first thinking was, oh, my God, who's going to be taking care of the children? Well, because we had developed such a wonderful wraparound natural support system for this family, it was the ministers that came forward from her church, and they rallied this incredible network of parishioners to support this family. So it really is both maximizing the formal systems and services and also maximizing the informal services and systems. And that really comes from the strength of the parents. You know, this particular family was very involved with their church. They were very willing to have us be part of that community so that we could really maximize wraparound services for everybody. That's just an incredible example of really services that are out there that are not very costly. But you need to really be able to build some teams around some families. And I think that's the work that is involved, and that's the work that's really important to do. But I also want to maximize the strength of our families. It is the strength of our families that are willing to come forward, to say what they need, to identify their own challenges and their own strengths, and then really together brainstorm about how to help you in these kind of crisis times, or how to help you sometimes daily. And, you know, Joe, you talk about complexity. I think one of the biggest challenges for our families, at least that we work with, is poverty. You know, it is very hard to manage. The East Coast is very, very expensive, and it's very hard to manage day-to-day lives when you have children and you have work or you can't work because of your disability. And so many times it's those issues related to poverty that we have to really wrap around services for. So, I am amazed often at the strengths of our families because they not only have to manage an illness, they have to manage their children, which, as we all know as parents, is there are good days and bad days in that. And they also have to really juggle the poverty issues that so many of our families struggle with. It takes very little sometimes to really have a crisis. If you lose your job or if your car breaks down and you can't get to work, it's those kind of factors that really is important to families to be able to provide those very sometimes small services that totally changes a family.
It reminds me of a woman who told me one time, don't offer me a 50-minute hour of therapy when what I really need is a mattress for my kid.
Right, exactly. Exactly. And I've learned from our families and from our parents a multitude of gratitude in terms of just how resilient people really are and just how resilient people want to be, and more importantly, how their children is their motivator for their own health. That's huge.
One other question I have is I know that the two of you are co-authoring a new book, which is supposed to be coming out this spring. And I'm assuming that a lot of the things we discussed here will be part of this new book. And could you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, we would love to talk to you about it. In fact, Joe, I'm picking it up tomorrow at the printers. So we're very excited. We finally have it, so it's actually going to be very, very much available. And I encourage people to visit our site at employmentoptions.org, where they will be able to have excerpts from the book within the next few weeks. So really it is about helping providers. You know, we've struggled back and forth, and Joanne can talk about this, about the perspective that we should have. And as much as we wanted to make sure that parents have resources, we really felt to really be able to change the system, we wanted to have providers begin to think about not only perhaps providing new services, but equally adapting existing services to really be able to deal and manage and work with parents and their families. And so that's really what this book is really about. And, it, you know, we call it family recovery because it's not just about parents. It is about the family. Joanne, you want to talk a little bit more about that?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, it reminds me of something that Maggie said in the broadcast last week when she was at a mental health facility for adults, and there was no, she asked about whether there was a waiting room or a playroom for children when adults were there. And I can't remember the setting exactly, but the point is that most adult mental health facilities don't have playrooms for kids. And so it's not that we're asking providers to overstep their training or professional boundaries. We're not asking them to become family therapists. We're asking them, if they're sitting with an adult patient, to remember that there might be children out there, and to ask, who's taking care of them? You know, where are they? Are they in the waiting room? Do they have something to play with while they're waiting? It sounds like it's sort of a trivial or simple thing, but I was struck by the fact that Maggie, too, had mentioned it last week, that there are lots of simple things that just don't occur to providers because they're not trained that way, or they haven't had the experience of thinking about. And here, Joe, we're talking about those invisible children that providers may not be thinking about, who would benefit from quite simple interventions. Some of the earliest interventions Tony did at her agency were things like helping parents plan birthday parties, or, you know, mustering the resources for Christmas presents. I mean, really what we're touting in this new book, which is called Creating Options for Family Recovery, is ways to support providers in thinking family, if you will, so that whether they're working with kids and wondering how parents are doing, or whether they're working with adults and maybe need to think about how kids are doing. Sort of any way you slice the pie, it's really the family that's at the center of it all.
And, you know, I think that it's in every setting. You know, I think of one mom who has her own child has mental health issues, and I remember the fact that she had to go and bring him to the emergency room. And because she had her own trauma about being hospitalized, she couldn't be in the waiting room any longer. She just couldn't do it. And so I suggested that she would leave and be able to kind of manage herself, and I would be there for her. And the first response of the psychiatric specialist was, well, mom apparently doesn't care about her child. Now, I was amazed, but more importantly, in that moment, it was a great teaching moment because I had to really then explain that this mom had her own trauma. And to watch her child go through another trauma at this moment was not going to help her. And I can only tell you, it was just that really teaching moment that changed this woman's perspective. So those, sometimes it is just changing people's thinking, and our hope is that this book will be able to really help people think about, in every stage of wherever people are in the system, what kind of things can you do to acknowledge that this person is a parent? What kind of things can you do to acknowledge that parental mental health is there? And yet, and more importantly, what can you do to really manage everyone's recovery? There are lots of moments that make big differences in people's lives. And as Joanne said, sometimes it's just very simple things. You know, if that nurse had come out and talked to that mom in a way to say to her, I'm really sorry you have to go through this, and not feel like she was being judged, that would have made all the difference in the world for her. She wasn't asking lots. She just needed some time for herself. Those are kind
well,
of
and
the
and the most important thing about that, Tony, is that if that mother had been supported in doing that and had been able to be there and be present with her child, it would have been so much better for the child. I mean,
that's right.
It can make such a huge difference
that's
for
right.
children.
That's right.
The way that parents are supported or not. And so ultimately, if your goal is to help that child navigate that emergency room situation, then you really want to be able to help the mom or the parent who's there do the best they can on behalf of that child. And that's like a win-win for everybody. That's mm-hmm. a win for the mom who's doing the right thing, and it's certainly a win for the child. And ultimately, it's probably a win for the providers, too, because the whole situation is easier to manage.
Right.
Well, thank you. I'm thinking it's about time to kind of see if there's any callers you'd be interested in asking a few questions. The number to call in, if you do have a comment, is area code 646-564-9557. Again, that is 646-564-9557. I guess one of the things that I've seen or not seen or kind of not sure about is that most of the, literature that I've seen really seems to be talking more about mothers than fathers. And you know, and the whole issue of, you know, are you supporting, you know, two-parent families or single parents, and then the issue of, you know, both the custodial parent and the non-custodial parent. And, how complicated can that get?
Well, I'd like to comment on that first, and then I'll throw it over to Tony because I know she has strong feelings about it. So I want to get my thing in first before Tony grabs it. But, you know, we, in our work and in our thinking about this, we basically define family as whoever the family defines as family. And so if it's a single parent and a child and a grandmother or grandfather, or if it's a single dad, or if it's a mother and father, however people define their family, I think, Tony, it's fair to say that that's however they walk through the door is how we think about them, that family is very much a personal definition. And it's true what you say, Joe, about fathers. Fathers have been, well, in general, in the literature about fathers and mothers and parenthood and people in general, it's only been, I don't know, maybe the past 10 years or 15 years that fathers have really been maybe 20 years, but, you know, it is, you're right. Absolutely. Fathers have been neglected, absolutely neglected. And people only recently have begun to do research on things like postpartum depression for fathers, or, you know, what it's like for fathers to have a new baby in the home, or what it's like for a father to be ill. And, you know, our colleagues in Australia have a lot of resources, well, more resources than we do here in the U.S. on their website, the Children of Parents with Mental Illness website, for fathers. Resources, videos, training materials and things, because fathers are really important. Whether they are the person with an illness, or whether they are the support person to the partner with an illness, or whether they're single dads, or, sort of whatever their life circumstance.
Correct. And, you know, I, as Joanne was teasing me, I feel very strong about non-custodial care parents being identified as parents and really making sure that moms and dads are acknowledged as a non-custodial care dad or a non-custodial care mom. And we make sure that we provide services for custodial care parents as well as non-custodial care parents. And what that would look like is to help a parent develop a supervised visit, if that's what the court is indicating is needed right now, and really make sure that the parent feels very much part of that child's life as much as possible during that visit. And I think that it is complex. You know, there are different issues for custodial care parents than non-custodial care parents, but that doesn't mean any less that a parent is less important. And so, as Joanne knows, I feel very strong about the role of non-custodial care parents and the identity that's really important for their children in their lives. And again, the motivator for them to stay as well as they can for their children, for their visit, is critical. And I've seen it over and over and over again. In terms of composition of parents that we serve, I have a number of dads that we serve. We have moms and dads and dual parent roles, and we have certainly single family parents, moms. So it's really, you know, a really composite of families. And we also have, which I think is because of the work that we've done, when there is a need for a non-custodial care parent to bring in, when possible, the foster mom or the parent that has the custodial care, the person that has the custodial care, so that everyone is on the same plane. We all can try to figure out how to really satisfy and support everyone's role, as Joanne said earlier, for the sake of the child, so that everyone is important and that everyone is identified as having an important role. So it is complex. Each family, I think, is individualized. But at the same token, I think what's the major theme is that every parent, custodial, non-custodial, wants to be the best parent they can be.
You know, I'm going to jump in and say something about some of the parents that we've worked with and children, adult children, young children, children of any age that we've worked with. And we have worked with parents with custody, parents without custody. We've also worked with parents who haven't seen their children in years. Mm-hmm. Maybe parents who have given their children up for adoption, which may well have been the right thing to do for them at the time. I mean, we're not saying that all parents are, you know, are all the time always able to care for their children. And that's probably true of people, whether they have mental illness or not. But what we are saying is that for the parent, whether the parent is caring 24/7 or hasn't seen their child in 25 years, and for the child, whether that child is living full-time with a parent or whether that child has been placed for adoption or whether that child has been in foster care or whether that child hasn't seen his parent for 25 years, the notion that someone is a parent or has a child or the notion that someone has a parent out there somewhere is really important. And we try to really respect that because it's a part of who you are. You know, it's at the core of your being. Whether you got along with that parent or not, that relationship, in a way, you know, contributes to who you are today. And your experiences in that family, your experiences with that parent, good, bad, they need to be respected, acknowledged, and dealt with in the way that's most helpful to the person who's dealing. Does that make sense, Tony?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, Joe, you said about your own personal experiences, and I think that every daughter, every son certainly can have many stories about their experience of having a parent with a mental health issue, and certainly I have my own story. And yet what's fascinating to me is when I listen to other children talk about their parents or adult children talking about their parents, the resiliency that we have all developed and our passion very often in the field is because of that. You know, I was saying to Joanne earlier that I don't necessarily identify myself personally in a way of saying I'm a daughter of. But at the same token, you know, I have had two parents, and because of those two parents, they both gave me an enormous amount of gifts and also enormous amount of challenges, no question about it. And that's really what we want to acknowledge with our kids that we service, And we also want to help our parents really identify that as well, so that the blame isn't there, that it doesn't mean that it's easy. It doesn't mean, you know, I wish that there was no illness, whether it was, you know, whether it's diabetes, cancer, or mental health issues. I wish no one had an illness. But the illness is in this family. How do we really look at this illness in a way that's not about blame, in a way that really, as much as possible, supports everybody? It's not easy. And as Joanne said, some parents have decided that it is best for the child to have the child be adopted. We just recently, 6 months ago, had a young adult parent who decided to put her child up for adoption. We went through that with that parent on every stage. And acknowledge that incredible, difficult process that she went through, and at the same token, really acknowledge that her decision was her decision, and that she did it out of love. And, you know, again, as Joanne said, we're really trying to honor everyone's path, whatever that is.
Thank you. Another thing that I've noticed, and I don't know how much it's been research, is that most of the stuff that I've read seems to look at younger children, you know, those who are from like 0 to 5 and supporting parents of younger children, and not as much on that transition to teen and some of the, and I didn't know if there's some stuff that I haven't seen that really looked at how do you help support parents, especially going through the different stages of a child's life.
Well, you know, I can just, before Joanne pops in there, I just want to say that, you know, not only is there a need to really have a better understanding of the impact for transitional age kids, but we also see young adults being also young parents. And that's another kind of group of folks that require a little bit of a different type of service than the traditional adult service. But that doesn't mean that that services can't be provided to young adult parents. I think one of the things that Joanne and I are trying to figure out, and I hear this dog barking.
Sorry.
One of the things that Joanne and I really want to try to get funding for that we've been able to hear from our international colleagues is a model called Let's Talk, so that parents can begin to really talk to their children, and particularly for early young adults, transitional age kids, about their illness and what it's like for them, and also what it's like for them as a young adult. That would be, you know, again, I think we haven't done that very well in our field, and I think parents need skills, providers need skills in how to initiate those conversations, but they're really important conversations to have. I don't know, Joanne, if you want to talk a little bit about that.
Well, you know, ironically, if you look at the scientific literature, it's teenagers that a lot of the work of prevention has been done. And I'm thinking about Bill Beardsley and a lot of his work coming out of Boston with, in this case, mothers with depression and their adolescent children, and helping families talk about mental health conditions and really laying the groundwork so that their children, their teenage children, don't develop their own mental health problems. And so that work, Joe, has really come out of we want to prevent psychopathology in the, quote, offspring of mothers with depression. But you're right, there has been a lot of research done, particularly on women, mothers, particularly with depression, and particularly with young children. And so I think while there are a few models like Bill's for intervening with adolescents, I think that's an area we need to learn a lot more about in this country. Now, ironically, in other countries, you know, this whole, the model of the young carer is really quite predominant in the UK, in Australia. I think Maggie talked a little bit about that last week, too, that there has been more attention paid to the notion that young people, and, you know, including adolescents, young adolescents and adolescents, may be in the position of providing care for parents with psychiatric disabilities as well as other medical conditions, and so it's not just a mental health focus, but and they actually are eligible for services and supports because of their identification as, quote, young carers, as youth caring for parents. But we don't have that in the U.S. so much at all, actually.
You know, I'm kind of new to this international community, and last year we had the international conference in California, and for those of us from the U.S., it was such an eye-opening experience to appreciate and realize how far behind the U.S. is in terms of services, that there are countries like Joanne has mentioned, Canada and Australia and Netherlands and so forth, and many other places that have so much progressed in terms of servicing families and in such a healthier, preventive kind of way. The U.S. is really focused on safety first, and in that safety kind of has a lens that hasn't always been about really maximizing the strengths of parents and really together, really pulling the systems together. So we have a lot to learn. We have other people in the international community we can learn from, but the U.S. has a long way to go.
Thank you. Well, I'm looking at the clock. Time has gone very quickly. We've got about 8 minutes left. I'm wondering if either of you want to have any additional comments that for questions that I did not ask that you feel is necessary for our audience to understand the work we're doing?
Well, I'd like to make another pitch for the Motherhood, Mental Illness, and Recovery book, which is actually the original reason why you invited us to be on the broadcast, Joe. And I just want to encourage people to take a look at it because it has so many wonderful personal stories from both mothers and adult children. The narratives are in sections titled Voices of Mothers, and so it's really about giving women voice, giving them opportunity to talk about their situations and the things that helped them and the things that didn't help them, and the multi-generational impact of mental health and mental illness, and again, the adult children's perspectives. And what was really interesting for me in looking at these narratives, first of all, they're incredibly powerful. And, you know, as a researcher, I have learned over the years that people's stories are oftentimes much more powerful than any amount of data I can generate by interviewing any number of parents and children and family members. And so I think they're very powerful stories, and it's interesting to think how we might actually use some of these stories. What's interesting is that so many of the themes are common across the lives of women, the experience of being alone, the fear of disclosure, the lack of support and understanding. And I think last week Maggie and Cherie talked about they didn't understand, that particularly daughters and sons did not feel as if many people understood what their lives were like. And the role of assumptions that people make about parents with mental illness, about what the lives of their children must be like. And it's only recently that people have begun to write about some of the positive aspects of having a parent with an illness, as well as so many of the negative aspects. Separations from kids and what this means for mothers and children, and especially the benefits of peer support, and not just receiving peer support, but of also getting to the place where you can provide peer support. And this is something that I think has been really important in the Daughters and Sons movement and in some of the Facebook groups that have developed and other social network arenas, is the notion that giving peer support is just as important as receiving peer support, and that you can get to the place where your experience can inform the way that you can help others in similar circumstances. And so I thought that was a very powerful piece, a common theme in these narratives. The role of trauma, the importance, my last big point, and then I'll turn it over to you, Tony, the importance of self-care and how hard that is for parents to prioritize when, you know, they're faced every day with what they perceive their children to need. And so the importance of self-care for all of us, and especially for those managing an illness, can't really be overstated. So I wanted to talk about those very powerful stories in the book and encourage people to take a look at them, because they're very moving and very uplifting, inspiring, and hopeful.
And I guess I just want to comment in terms of employment options as an adult agency. That's what we've been for, you know, 50 years. And 25 years ago, when we started thinking about servicing families, I had to approach our board, and it was a big discussion, a big concern. What does it mean when you have kids involved? You know, just things like car seats and vans, simple things that can get sometimes very complex and challenging for board of directors. And I remember one board member saying it all and changing the dynamics that night. And what he said was, I don't have a mental health issue, but I know how hard it is to be a parent. Now maximize that and couple that with any chronic illness. What, you know, of course we have to do this. And that, I think, is really what it's about. It's really, really embracing whatever role we all play in this field, to really be able to acknowledge that parenting is challenging, parenting is hard, and now add that with a major complexity of mental health issues. So it is everyone's obligation to change our services and adapt them in ways to really support people. And so, you know, I feel very strong about that. Our board has felt very strong about that for 25 years. And we're going to continue to really try to adapt and help other providers and other people think about parents and think about family recovery.
Well, I'd like to thank both of you for joining me this evening. I think this has been very helpful, and I hope others can benefit from it. We've got a couple more minutes. Tell you a little bit about what we got coming up next week. Next week we have Joanne Riebschlager, who's an associate professor at Michigan State, who does more work with younger people, the younger daughters and sons. So, and she'll be discussing a program that she's developed with folks locally there that does some mental health literacy for middle school children of parents with mental illness. So we're feeling really excited about that. And then on January 20th, we're going to come back and we're going to talk about stigma. And there's been a lot of discussion in the last decade about stigma of having a mental illness and discrimination and all that kind of stuff, but we're going to focus on what does stigma look like when you are a daughter or a son of a parent with mental illness, and
excellent.
how we kind of feel that and see that. So that's going to be our January 20th show. I thank everyone for listening.
Well, thanks for having us.
Yes, very much so.
And we'll see you next week. Goodbye.
Thanks, Joe.
Bye.